In Ireland, nothing gets us talking like lions.
Tea?
Small talk.
Well, Jimmy, shocking weather we're having.
Big talk.
Even I could have played county. Office talk.
I'm MIA in the AM, but I'll circle back on the KPIs.
Real talk.
Milk before tea? Should be a criminal offence.
You could say we talk too much.
But the truth is,
we don't talk nearly enough. Lions puts the talk into tea.
The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman on News Talk
with the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Now, earlier today, the COVID-19 evaluation roundtable convened where global health experts assessed Ireland's management and experience of the pandemic to learn for the future. The evaluation is headed by Professor Anne Scott with former World Health Organization Deputy Director Mike Ryan in attendance, as well as experts from Sweden and the UK, including my next guest. Professor Mark Woolhouse is an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Edinburgh who advised the UK and Scottish governments during the pandemic. Professor, you're very welcome to the show and thank you for joining us in studio. I read with great interest some of your contributions from earlier, including when you were saying that you believe the public were treated to some extent like they were part of the problem.
Well, I'll speak for Scotland and the UK, which is my experience. I was on some of the advisory groups in both of those countries. And that was a recurring theme, certainly of the early months of the epidemic, that the public had actions done for them and not developed with them. That was a continual criticism of the way that policy and the public interacted. And that was a theme that was revisited this morning at the meeting of the evaluation.
I would agree that that was very much the case here. Ireland was not allowed, in fact, they were discouraged from using antigen testing as a population for about a year after the rest of Europe and the UK would have been using them very commonly. And we were told by members of our NPHET, which was our National Public Health Emergency Team, that that was because they could be corrupted, that people could smear butter on them, it was said by one of the members of NPHET, and therefore they wouldn't be accurate. And I have to say, considering the length and the severity of lockdown here and what people were enduring, I thought it was one of the most insulting things I'd ever heard be say to the public.
We had a similar and related difficulty in Scotland. So there we didn't roll out mass testing, the self-testing using the lateral flow tests, for about a year after the technology had been tested in the field and proved to work. And in that year, we were subject to many restrictions, and including one very long and harsh lockdown in early 2021. Eventually, the self-testing was rolled out towards the end of 2021, and my interpretation is that the self-testing kept us out of another lockdown when the Omicron wave came along there. And that's because the uptake of it in Scotland was extremely impressive. More than 80% of the population were using those tests once a week, and more than 50% of them were using multiple times in a week. People really embraced this technology. And why did they do that? They wanted to know their own infection status so that they could manage the risk to themselves and those around them. And yet, as with Ireland, there was reluctance by the public health agencies to give the public access to that.
Yeah, despite the fact that, and here people were very compliant with lockdown, they were adhering to all the public health sort of advice, they were doing the, you know, the social distancing. People were very sensible and people very motivated, and that didn't happen. You also said, and I was very interested too, because this would have been said to us very much here as well, that it was wrong to say the virus did not differentiate and that everyone was at risk. We had the longest school lockdowns in Europe here in Ireland. We didn't even have, you know, in the UK, you kept schools open for children with special needs. In Australia, for example, they kept schools open for frontline workers, all that kind of stuff for their children. We had a blanket closure of schools here, which we haven't really recovered from in terms of our absenteeism from school, and our school refusal rates have gone through the roof. 40% of primary school students now in our schools in deprived areas are missing more than 20 days. That's our cutoff for significant absenteeism. We're missing more than 20 days a year, and we think probably much more than that as well. And I think that really went down the pan after those long, long lockdowns when children attending school, that relationship seemed to unravel. Talk to me a little bit about how we didn't differentiate and what we should have been told about the different risks people were at.
Well, to start with, in the early stages of the pandemic, when we all went into those first lockdowns, March 2020, we didn't have a perfect understanding. There was no positive evidence that this virus was transmitting well in schools, but there was no contrary evidence either. We didn't know. And so I think it wasn't unreasonable that people were cautious. I'm a father myself, of course.
I fully agree.
But it very rapidly became apparent from data coming in from all over the world in the next few weeks, really, that schools were not playing a big part in this pandemic. And there was tremendous resistance to the data, not only from policymakers and politicians, but also actually from some members of the public and including some people involved with schools. In the UK, the teachers' unions were not at all sympathetic to reopening schools. The data kept coming in, and eventually, in Scotland at least, it overwhelmed the objections. It was so clear that it was safe to reopen schools that we did it in August. But even then, we could have reopened them much earlier that year. And you're quite right about the harms. We are still learning what harms we have done to the children. The lockdowns, as I say, understandable perhaps in the early stages, but to keep them going for so long and to reintroduce them when the evidence was absolutely clear, I think has been a tremendous disservice to the next generation.
I fully agree with you. I remember arguing with a professor of public health, as it happened, on the radio, about the fact that young people were not, and it was not being said, but it was the case because we were reading the evidence that young people were not at the kind of risk that older people were at, and to treat everyone the same was doing significant harm to young people. And I remember him saying to me on air, this professor, he said, look, I've seen young people in ICU with COVID. And he says, that's not an anecdote because I've seen it. And I said, with respect to you, Professor, that is the definition of an anecdote. The stats do not bear this out. Seeing one or two people who are young, perhaps with other more comorbidities, is totally different than suggesting that young people were at the kind of risk that older people were at. Why did this happen in your view, Mark? Why were we, to me, it seemed like fear was governing the country rather than rationality or evidence.
Well, one of the striking things you kept coming across in that situation was, well, we all know that children are virus factories. We all know that schools,
vectors,
all of that sort of terminology. And of course, we know it because for many diseases, it's true. But it wasn't true of COVID. And we had a very early clue that it wasn't. The virus that COVID is most similar to, most closely related to, was SARS,
yeah,
which caused epidemics in the early 2000s. And that was the same. Unusually for a virus, it did not particularly affect children. It was a more severe virus, so some children did get ill. But it showed the same pattern. And we didn't pick up on those clues. We didn't act on the evidence. We just continued to behave as if children were a problem. And it got so bad that, of course, people who were involved in schools, particularly teachers, became understandably very frightened about their own health. But again, there was very little evidence once the schools did reopen that if teachers were getting infected, they were actually getting infected in the classroom. Everyone yeah. thought they would be, but they weren't. The evidence was quite clear.
But equally vulnerable teachers could have been treated in a different way to ordinary teachers who maybe had no vulnerability. I was very interested in something you said. You said that the response of government organisations and public health bodies was absolutely dominated by public health and there was scant regard for wider societal harms. That would be my entire reading of how we behaved during COVID. And, you know, I heard Professor Anthony Staines, for example, earlier saying he believed that our NEFIT was our group, the National Public Health Emergency Team, that the wrong levels of expertise were contained within the groups. Is that something to do with it? Why were we so blissfully disinterested in wider societal harms when they were clear from reasonably early on?
Well, in the UK, it's absolutely for the reason you gave, is the advisory committees were stacked with clinicians and public health experts whose job is to protect lives, protect health. And that's what they were focused on. There was no representation at all from economists, even from mental health experts in the same, for people working in the jobs market, who understand business, how businesses work in the travel industry, anything like that. There was no representation from those other interests. I mean, one of the things I said in the UK at a select committee was our response to this pandemic is completely dominated by epidemiologists, far too much, in my opinion, and I'm an epidemiologist. And that persisted for a very long time.
I said I thought our response was being dominated far too much by doctors, and I'm a doctor, and I still believe that. There was an argument put out at the time that anyone who pushed back against this was favouring wealth over health, and health is clearly more important. But that's not solely true either, is it? I mean, there were so many things, like you're talking about mental health, like you're talking about children's education and their developmental milestones, their societal development, all of those things. Was there just a poor understanding of all of this as well, do you think, at the time?
Well, what there wasn't was a proper consideration of, since we clearly need to do something to control this virus, what are the alternatives to lockdown? And it was very striking, again, on the UK side, that the government never asked their scientists a very simple question. What could we do to stay out of lockdown? Now, in my view, that actually should now become, for the UK, for Ireland, around the world, a policy objective, staying out of lockdown. You can't deliver that by decree. You have to have a plan, a pandemic preparedness plan, that says how you're going to keep people out of lockdown. And at the evaluation this morning, I explained that the answer to that is actually quite straightforward. Early action can be less drastic action. You don't have to impose really harsh measures on the whole population to drive down the number of cases if you haven't let them rise up in the first place. So you can always act less drastically if you act earlier. There's always that trade-off. We never took it. What we kept doing was acting late.
Yeah, and the harms of lockdown were not recognised. I mean, the fallout we're seeing from COVID today, and we still talk about the fallout from COVID here, is not actually from the disease, it's from the lockdowns. It's urban issues, antisocial behaviour, people have ceded the streets, all sorts of things have happened. Maybe lastly, can I ask you just about Sweden? Because I know there was experts from Sweden there, and of course Sweden didn't follow the lockdown model in the same way that other places did. There were certain restrictions, they encouraged people to work from home, they did ban large sort of super spreader, as we used to say, events. But there were other things that people were allowed to do in Sweden that they certainly weren't allowed to do here, and perhaps not in the UK. With the value of hindsight, shielding and more targeted lockdowns, less restrictive lockdowns, is that, in your view, the way that we should manage future pandemics?
Well, the first way is the one I just said, is we really have
speedy action.
Speedy action. We have to get in there early so that we don't let the situation deteriorate to an extent where we're even considering more drastic measures. But you asked me earlier about the risks. When you're dealing with a public health threat, a virus that is 10,000 times more deadly to a 70-year-old than a 15-year-old. 10,000 times. They're almost different diseases. You should be concentrating your thinking, how do I protect the 70-year-old?
Yeah.
They are at significant risk. The rest of the population, not so much. And what happened, in my view, is we were so fixated on this idea that everyone's at risk that we, in a sense, diluted our attention and forgot to pay adequate attention to protecting the small minority of well-defined people. We knew what the risk factors were, and we failed to do enough to protect them. And in my view, in Scotland, and it may be the case in Ireland, I haven't looked at the numbers, but many, many people, thousands of people died because we didn't do all we could do to protect them because we were concentrating on things like lockdown.
Universal measures.
One last detail. Lockdown was least effective at protecting the most vulnerable because that is a group that really can't self-isolate. They need care. They need healthcare. They need social care. They need companionship. They need looking after. That's the definition of vulnerable. You can't self-isolate and be vulnerable. Lockdown did the least to protect the people who needed it most.
Professor Mark Woolhouse of the University of Edinburgh, thank you very much for joining us. Shane, that is a fascinating insight, I think, into how we behaved. And that question that Professor Woolhouse said there that we should have been asking, that I don't think I heard anyone ask, what could we do to stay out of lockdown? That should have been the questions that we asked, and we didn't even care. We just kept throwing ourselves back into it. I also think we gave too much power to Neffet, and our politicians surrendered a leadership role when we needed them most. And we shouldn't forget that they ran scared from dealing with this, and they passed it over to people who were not.
There was a backlash,
broad thinking in their
backlash
understanding
from the wider public when politicians did start to take issue with NPHET. I mean, Leo Varadkar famously went on television
and apologised.
Well, he firstly questioned what NPHET was doing, and he had to backpedal pretty quickly.
He did, because, you know what, it strikes me that when we get fevered about any issue, which we did about COVID and we have about other issues, rationality and intellectual rigour goes out the window. And politicians were needed at that time, and they kind of ran scared of it.
Let us know what you think. 087 1400 106.
The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays at 4 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.